From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. On today's program, the Larry Nassar sentencing hearing continues for a fifth day of sexual assault survivors confronting the disgraced sports doctor.
I'm possibly the last child he will ever assault.
Plus, sports commentator John U. Bacon on how Michigan State University is handling the scandal. Then, a look at the mass media landscape, including big TV mergers that could change your local news.
To what degree does that mean that the kind of television news that's going to be pushed in is being created elsewhere in its sort of generalized coverage of stories rather than particular coverage of stories that are meaningful to different communities?
Also, Grand Rapids is looking at ways to completely eliminate greenhouse gas emissions from buildings, but at what cost?
We can hopefully incentivize those energy efficiencies and renewable energy without having significant financial impact.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Grand Rapids is one of 12 U.S. cities participating in a three-year initiative called the Zero Cities Project. The idea is to come up with a blueprint for getting to zero net carbon in the building sector by 2050. And that means all buildings, not just those owned by the city.
We can hopefully incentivize those energy efficiencies and renewable energy without having significant financial impact.
We'll find out how the city plans to make that happen later this hour. But first, today is the fifth day of sentencing hearing for Larry Nassar. He's the former Michigan State University sports doctor charged with sexual assault. A note of warning, some listeners might find parts of this report disturbing. Before it's over, more than 100 girls and women survivors will have made statements to Nassar and the institutions, the people who might have been able to stop the abuse. Today, the court heard from Emma Ann Miller, 15 years old, who had monthly appointments with Larry Nassar.
I, too, was sexually assaulted by Larry Nassar, multiple times, at multiple appointments. My last treatment was in August 2016. A week later, he was let go by MSU. I'm possibly the last child he will ever assault.
Joining us now is Michigan Radio's Kate Wells, who once again is in the courtroom today. Kate, what else did you hear today?
Yeah, Emma Ann was an incredibly powerful speaker this morning. I think she spoke for a lot of people in the courtroom and really wowed a lot of people in the courtroom, because here's this 15-year-old girl who comes up to the stand with her mom, and she clearly was struggling through a lot of her testimony. You know, she had to take some deep breaths. One time, a couple times, her mom had to give her a hug. Her mom would whisper to her, "Take a deep breath. You're doing great." But man, when she got her voice, it was a very strong voice. She directed, obviously, a lot of her anger towards Larry Nassar. She described horrific abuse that she had to endure. At one point, she says, in a supply closet, which gives you a sense of how little supervision was happening at times when these women were being abused. And she also said that she puts a lot of the responsibility on Michigan State University for ignoring reports for 20 years that Nassar was abusing women and girls. But she also said, you know, I am a Michigan State fan. I am a proud Spartan fan, and Michigan State is bigger than this.
I don't have to be ashamed or anti-MSU. I can be a Spartan if I choose. I can yell, "Go green, go green." Let me say that again, Judge, because I don't think the crowd heard me. Go green!
Go away!
I can root for Miles Bridges if I want and still hold you, MSU, accountable. And I will. You are no more powerful than Nassar. You don't hold any power over me either, and never will. And not just MSU, but all the individuals who could have stopped this. Every single one of them.
Again, that was Emma Ann Miller. She's 15 years old. Kate, the testimony or the statements that these women and girls have been making has been more moving than I think anybody would have expected or imagined, because of the strength of many of these voices, even a 15-year-old like this. What else are we going to be hearing for the next couple of days?
Well, so we now are at 144 women and girls who are expected to speak. That number keeps growing because prosecutors say every day and over the weekend they are hearing from more women. Sometimes these are victims that have not come forward up until now. Sometimes these are victims that prosecutors were aware of, but these women didn't want to make their statements publicly. And I think one of the things that was so powerful about Emma Ann's statement was and hearing that from the court, hear the go green, the go white thing. You know, what gets lost when we talk about MSU in this case is how many people are local to Lansing and East Lansing. How many of these victims, you know, graduated from MSU or are still at MSU, and their families, you know, are generations long MSU fans. And so you have a lot of people for whom this feels like the entire world that they live in right now is caught up in this, and that it just affects every level of their lives. So to have Emma Ann at 15 get up there and lead the crowd in a go green, go white was a pretty interesting moment.
That's Michigan Radio's Kate Wells. Thanks very much, Kate.
Thanks, Lester.
While the Nassar sentencing hearing continues, the top leadership of the board of directors at USA Gymnastics resigned today. According to USA Today, the chair, vice chair, and treasurer are out. And there are more demands for the resignation of Michigan State University President Lou Anna Simon. While the MSU Board of Trustees again stated its support for the president on Friday, one trustee, Mitch Lyons, has broken with the rest of the board. He says Simon has lost the confidence of the public. Joining me to talk about some of the issues facing the university is Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. All right, John, let's start with trustee Mitch Lyons, his call for President Simon's resignation. He's only one of eight trustees. Does his break with the rest of the board matter?
It will make a difference. It will not obviously tip the scales yet, but it does show a crack in the wall, which is not therefore unified, and it will hold up well in history, frankly, because this is going to happen sooner or later, in my opinion, anyway, and Mitch is ahead of the curve.
The president and the board have repeatedly said they have a legal obligation not to comment on this beyond stating their empathy for the victims. There are civil suits filed against the university. The monetary damage could be substantial. What damage to the university's reputation might be because of this lack of transparency?
And that's where you're going to win the battle but lose the war. Because, okay, you're going to be less culpable when the lawsuits start and so on. And yet, this case is being played out in the court of public opinion, not just the courts of Ingham County, of course. So they are screwing this one up and badly. Don Canham, the old athletic director at Michigan, famously said, never turn a one-day story into a two-day story. That's past. You got a one-year story. You want a two-year story, and you're about to get one. So they have screwed this one up, in my opinion. And Michigan, the Michigan Hospital, a few years ago, went to a very smart policy with their doctors. When you make a mistake, go see the patient and apologize and treat them like a human being, which every lawyer will tell you, never, ever do that. And malpractice suits have been cut dramatically because of it, because it turns out people like people acting like human beings, and they have screwed that one up.
Let's talk about the issues beyond the courtroom. In a detailed report, Sports Illustrated's legal analyst Michael McCann described the legal issues ahead and whether the NCAA might implement sanctions against Michigan State. The precedent's been set because of the Penn State scandal involving Jerry Sandusky, who raped young boys. The NCAA punished Penn State. What does that mean for Michigan State?
It is almost impossible to predict because the NCAA is not driven by any moral compass that I've been able to determine, covering them for many years in many cases. They are both sheriff and saloon keeper, and that's the problem. They used to be merely rule enforcement, and now they're also a gigantic moneymaker on basketball, $1 billion a year at least. So you don't know how they're going to rule on these things. You really don't. They normally do not get involved in felonies like this. The case of the Baylor basketball player who was killed by a teammate they stayed out of. At University of Virginia, a male lacrosse player killed his girlfriend, who was on the women's team, and the NCAA did not get involved. Penn State got involved deeply. Now, it's my opinion, as serious as these things are, that is exactly why the NCAA should not be involved. They're meter readers, man. They should not be handling felonies, frankly. What happens here depends largely on public pressure. That's been my observation.
Even if they were to sanction Michigan State University, would it be limited to the gymnastic program?
That's a thing also. In the last 26 years, Michigan's won the last 22 gymnastics titles. Michigan State has never won one in the history of this Big Ten sport. So if they sanction women's gymnastics at Michigan State, it won't matter much as far as competition or national prestige. It will, of course, screw up the very people who've already been damaged in the first place, and that is the athletes. So that strikes me as not the right solution.
Finally, Michigan State's basketball coach Tom Izzo was harshly criticized by the mother of one of the Olympians who's been identified as one of Nassar's victims. Izzo, according to the Free Press, stated, "I hope the right person was convicted." The mother of Allie Raisman tweeted to Izzo in response to that statement, "I wonder if you're a complete and total moron or just a liar when you claim you listened to the impact statements," meaning the impact statements of the victims. I read the rest of Izzo's statement, which seems respectful. Why would he question whether the right person has been convicted?
Sloppy speaking, that's all. I know Tom pretty well. He came out this morning with a revision of that. Of course, he realized that he screwed up as far as that goes. He was otherwise, I thought, very respectful. But this is a guy who was talking about his boss's boss who paid him $7 million a year to coach basketball. This guy's in a rock and a hard place.
What do you think is going to happen with the president?
I think she's going to go sooner than later, and the house of cards is going to crumble, and the trustees are behind the curve, and they'll have to show up with their tails between their legs on this one.
John U. Bacon is Michigan Radio sports commentator and, of course, a New York Times best-selling author. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Tune in to Stateside tomorrow when we'll discuss Michigan State University's legal situation with Michael McCann, the sports law professor at the University of New Hampshire School of Law and Sports Illustrated's legal analyst that we mentioned earlier. We'll look at MSU's exposure to civil liability in the Nassar scandal, discuss the university's move to have the victims' lawsuits dismissed, and find out what strategies attorneys for Nassar's victims might employ in the months and years ahead. That's tomorrow on Stateside. Still to come, despite the stereotypes, are single women happier than married women?
There are many single people who love their lives and specifically love being single. And they enjoy the freedom and the autonomy that goes along with it.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside for Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty.
Collaboration.
Innovation.
The next idea.
The world doesn't stop. The world continues to change. So we as people need to change along with it.
While the federal government is no longer making climate change action plans a priority, some states and cities are stepping up. But there are hurdles to reducing greenhouse gas emissions that cause climate change. One of the biggest hurdles is an energy efficiency standard for buildings. Today's guest on The Next Idea is leading Grand Rapids' effort in a program called Zero Cities Project. Here to tell us about that is the sustainability manager of Grand Rapids, Allison Waskey-Sutter. Welcome.
Thank you.
So we already have LEED certified buildings and we have ENERGY STAR ratings. Why do we need another program like Zero Cities?
Well, Zero Cities is really more of a program focused on city policy that can help incentivize all building owners to implement energy efficiency or renewable energy. And the goal is to look at some policy opportunities that might not be as costly as LEED or other certification processes or as intense, and also those that can apply for existing buildings.
You're talking about zero net carbon. Can you explain what that means?
Yes. So zero net carbon is when you have a building that either produces on-site or purchases enough carbon-free renewable energy to meet the building's energy consumption. So you can install solar panels, or you could purchase renewable energy to offset all of the energy that's being consumed by the building.
So Grand Rapids is one of 12 cities working on this project. What's the immediate goal over the next 3 years?
The goal long term is to create a policy roadmap that will help us work toward achieving a zero carbon building sector. It's really laid out kind of in a 3-year plan, with this first year really focused attention on kind of evaluating our current policies, what type of incentives we have in place, and getting a handle on what is the carbon footprint of Grand Rapids building stock. So that's our immediate focus right now.
So eventually a blueprint for getting to zero net carbon for all buildings in Grand Rapids, and that's by 2050. That sounds really ambitious, especially when you consider there are a lot of buildings and homes that will need substantial investment to reach zero net carbon. Who's paying for that?
Well, the idea is really to couple economic incentives as well as some of our own planning and development policies to look at perhaps carrot approaches that may not have additional costs associated with them, or are there some opportunities that may include requirements for building owners to look at going beyond existing energy code or providing some additional tax incentives if they are willing to really look at energy efficiency and move toward this zero net carbon. So part of the entire evaluation process is going to be the realm of all policies available, but being mindful of, are those costly, what's the most affordable, and then what's the best approach moving forward for all building types in the city.
Is this going to take an inventory of building and home stock and then an inspection of each one to determine whether their needs can be met to reach zero net carbon?
Right now, one of the actions that I'm working on is that inventory of our entire building stock. So have had some great partners here within the city as well as some of our community partners helping to collect all of that data so that the Urban Sustainability Directors Network can do a high-level estimate of what is the carbon footprint of the entire building stock, inclusive of single-family homes, for the city of Grand Rapids. At this time, I don't believe that there will be any inspections or kind of auditing that's on the radar at this time, but we're doing more of kind of a high level looking at the types of buildings that we have here in Grand Rapids. What are our weather patterns? What are the types of energy that's being consumed to power our buildings?
Only 12 cities are involved in this first step of the Zero Cities project. Why was it important for Grand Rapids to get involved this early?
I think it's really great that Grand Rapids is involved. We're really representing the Midwest along with Minneapolis. So only two cities from the Midwest are going to be included. And of course, we want to help move the needle here in the Midwest along with, you know, some of those leaders that you find on in the coastal areas that are addressing a number of these concerns. But it was really brought to the attention of the organizers that the Midwest didn't have any representation, and a key partner of ours, the U.S. Green Building Council West Michigan chapter led by Sherry Holman, was at a conference where this project was being discussed, and she indicated that this really aligned with a lot of the City of Grand Rapids goals and programs, our 2030 district, and suggested that the team take a look at Grand Rapids. Then that kind of created a process where there was an evaluation done, and the organization realized that we really have some great things going on here in Grand Rapids and invited us to participate.
While making buildings more energy efficient to get to zero net carbon as a possibility, you still will need more energy from renewable sources such as wind and solar. Where will you be getting that?
Personally, I would really like to see a commitment to trying to supply as much renewable energy from our own Michigan economy here, but there are options and opportunities where businesses or building owners can look outside of the state of Michigan to procure some of that renewable energy to offset the building consumption.
I'm wondering what the likelihood is of unintended consequences such as higher housing costs, higher costs for business space.
That's definitely something that we're going to be working with the Urban Sustainability Directors Network on into being able to evaluate. Really, the second phase of this project is focused on engaging the community and being very mindful of disparate impacts on low-income communities or communities of color that have historically seen more impacts from some of these changes that are taking place. And so that's definitely going to be top of mind, to be very mindful about, you know, are these types of policies or programs going to increase costs for homeowners, for building owners, for businesses, and how can we ensure that we're taking that into consideration and hearing from the community about what can we do, what are some of the best incentives and some of the best planning processes that we can hopefully incentivize those energy efficiencies and renewable energy without having significant financial impact.
Allison Wosky-Sutter is Sustainability Manager at Grand Rapids and leading the Project Zero Cities in Grand Rapids. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Literature and pop culture haven't been particularly kind to single women. I mean, just think of those common terms, spinster or old maid. Writer Maureen Paraventi is taking those mean-spirited terms and turning them inside out to come up with a modern look at today's women who choose not to marry. Her new book is The New Old Maid, Satisfied Single Woman. Paraventi is a Detroit-based journalist, novelist, and playwright, and she spoke with Stateside's Cynthia Canty.
It's a pleasure to welcome you to Stateside, Maureen.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Who qualifies as a new old maid?
Well, I started with women who have never been married, and I use the age 40 as sort of a benchmark, because by 40, we've made a lot of our major life choices. And also by 40, many people are perceived as being old maids if they haven't married yet. So I interviewed women aged 40 to 70 from all over the United States to find out about their experiences and feelings and what their lives were like as single women.
So where do you think that traditional view of unmarried women came from? You know, the mean-spirited portrayals of unhappy spinsters in literature. I think of folk songs like Old Maid in a Garret. Oh, dear me, how would it be if I die an old maid in a garret? I mean, my Lord.
Yes.
It's so mean.
It is mean, and it the negative stereotype permeates popular culture, or at least it used to. I have an example in the book of a great movie that we all love, It's a Wonderful Life, where Jimmy Stewart's character is presented with the alternate reality of life, how it would be if he hadn't been in it. And his wife, who we've already met and is a lovely, vivacious woman, is suddenly a timid old maid.
A librarian.
A librarian with thick glasses and ugly clothes, who screams when he says, that's my wife. She's so afraid of men. And we got that. We got Jane Hathaway in the Beverly Hillbillies. We've got all kinds of movies and books that portray single women as being very unhappy, sort of dried up and unfulfilled.
Where did that come from, do you think?
Men.
Mm. Men, male writers.
I have to think that there might be some men who, at least historically, were threatened by the idea of women who didn't need men.
Where'd you come up with that title, New Old Maid, for your book? I mean, why is that so significant?
Because I think that things are changing. The marriage rate in the United States is declining. I don't think marriage in any way is in danger of disappearing. But there are fewer and fewer people who are getting married. Or if they do, the age at which they get married for the first time is older than it was in the past, which means we're spending more of our lives as single people. So I wanted to turn it around and say, especially once I talked to the women who are featured in the book, that the idea of an unhappy old maid is not a truthful one. There are many single people who love their lives and specifically love being single. They enjoy the freedom and the autonomy that goes along with it.
Let's talk about some of the women we meet in your book, because you are really trying to show women of all ages that there are lots of life options outside of getting the Mrs. degree, as I remember my mother referring to
it. Oh, yes.
It. She got her chemistry degree, and then she got her Mrs. degree, and she never worked a day out of the house after she got married.
Wow.
Yeah, and that was the, you know, that was the 40s. So what kind of life options do the women in your book discover?
Several of them are entrepreneurs. They founded businesses that allowed them to do what they love. One of them is in Ann Arbor. Stephanie Schneiderman has a specified travel business where she takes people to Colombia, Mexico, Cuba, I believe Guatemala, and it's very specific tours. If you're interested in crafts or the culinary adventure, you can sign up for that. She loves to travel. Would she be able to do all this travel if she were married, at least in a conventional marriage? Probably not. We've got women who are, one is a fashion designer in North Carolina. She's reinvented herself several times. She founded a successful healthcare company and ran that for a while, but now she's doing what she really loves, which is to empower plus-sized women with beautiful clothing.
So she's got the freedom to be able to say, you know, I'm going to close this chapter and open a new one.
She's got the freedom. I talked to a nurse anesthetist. She had a very intense relationship early on. It broke up. And she decided at that point that she was going to really focus on her career. And she said, the more education I got, the more money I made, and the more successful I became, the less I wanted to be married. And she's had a number of wonderful relationships. She's in one right now. But she doesn't necessarily feel the need to tie the knot.
So here we are talking about the kinds of opportunities that women are pursuing because they're single. What kind of stories did you hear about why they chose to stay single? I mean, was it a matter of they chose, or did life kind of just move them along in that direction and they're making, you know, they're taking what they have? How does it work out?
For most of them, it wasn't a specific choice. It was simply a matter of how their lives evolved. And one of the women, and I should have mentioned her earlier, Eleanor Wells, got a job offer from a company in Australia when she was 60 years old. And she said, yep. She said, I thought about it for 5 minutes. There was no one else I had to consult, and I went, and she's loving it. She had to move halfway across the world, learn new slang, and it's wonderful for her.
But these women we're talking about, I'm sure felt that traditional pressure to get married, the kind of pressure men don't feel, right? Do men feel that pressure?
They don't seem to. These women did feel it. I felt it. You encounter people who, when you're just meeting them and they find out that you've never been married, they're astounded. I get the, what happened? You're so attractive. You have a great personality. What happened? And the implication is that I failed somehow. I didn't snag a man. And a lot of the women in the book that I talked to have had similar reactions from people. And it's strange.
What about age differential? I'm wondering if, as you talk to women, are you getting a sense that the pressure a woman feels might depend on her age? I guess I'm wondering, do you get different takes from women who are in their 20s today versus women in their 40s, 50s, or beyond? Is it different for today's young women?
Or? Millennials that I've talked to, and I didn't include them in the book, yeah. But I do talk to millennials to find out what they're thinking. They're very ambivalent about marriage. Whether or not they're in committed relationships, they don't seem to feel the need to formalize it. Or at least a lot of them don't. Some of them, of course, are moving on toward marriage. Some of them are going to take the traditional path, but not all of them feel the need to, like their predecessors would have decades ago.
Their moms, their grandmas.
Oh, yeah. And moms and grandmas have to adjust to that.
I was going
to
say that probably sets up tensions with moms and grandmas who want to see their lovely daughter or granddaughter with a ring.
A lot of them do. They want to go wedding dress shopping with them. They want grandchildren. And that brings up another issue that I do go into in the book. A lot of the women that I spoke with didn't want children. And that's another thing that makes you question yourself as a woman. Is there something wrong with me that I don't feel the strong urge to have children? In my take, I think motherhood is the most important role. And if you are not totally committed to it, if it isn't incredibly important to you, you shouldn't do it because you won't bring all the energy and all the commitment to it that it needs.
Do you think in writing this book and in talking to all of these women, did you want to try to figure out if single women are happier than married women? Was that one of the goals of the book in your mind?
Absolutely.
And what do you think?
I think the ones that I spoke with are happier. This is a self-selecting group of women who were willing to discuss their personal lives with me. There may be other women out there who are not happy, who would not step up and speak with
me. Well, do we meet any women in your book who are like, oh, I wish I had gotten married, I didn't, so I'm kind of forging along, or is everybody pretty sunny about it?
They're sunny about it now. They weren't always sunny about it. Some of them had to get there. Some of them went through what I went through, which is, what's wrong with me? Is there something, you know, do I have a fatal flaw that prevents me from finding a relationship that will lead to marriage? And eventually, they all got to a happy place because they realized that there are benefits to being single.
What do you hope that people will take away from reading The New Old Maid?
I would love this book to start a conversation that leaves single women feeling empowered. They don't have to doubt themselves. They don't have to think, oh, did I make a huge mistake here? They can live lives just as fully as married women and feel as fulfilled. And in some ways, they can have a lot more adventures because they can do whatever they want.
How about women who are single after having been married? Either they're no longer married through divorce or through becoming widows.
They can also learn from this because they do have to figure out how to fly solo. I had an interesting conversation recently with a woman who is in a widow support group. And what surprised her are the number of women in that group who've said, I'm free now. The house is mine now. I can do whatever I want now. Some of them, and it should be said, some of these were older women, were in marriages that were not necessarily happy for them, but they stayed in them because that is what you do. Now they're going to have to figure out, though, how to manage their lives on their own, and the women in this book can give them a lot of tips on that, I think.
The book is The New Old Maid, Satisfied Single Women by Maureen Paraventi. The New Old Maid, Satisfied Single Women. Maureen Paraventi, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. There are big changes ahead in 2018 that could affect the way you watch, listen, and read mass media. Up next, we'll take a look at what's in store for consumers. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Well, we rang out the old year with a cascade of headlines about the mass media industry, which means things could play out this year that could affect what you watch, read, or listen to, and what you'll pay to do it. Amanda Lotz is a professor of media studies at the University of Michigan. She spoke with Cynthia Canty about all of the media issues bubbling away at the front burner.
Good to see you back. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, I'm glad to be here, Cynthia.
So mergers, investments, and net neutrality. And I think these are all things that most of us do not give a lot of bandwidth to in our day-to-day lives. I'm sure you encounter that a lot. But when we sit down in the evening and turn on TV and we want to watch Peaky Blinders on Netflix or Game of Thrones on our cable provider, these are things that are really going to matter.
They might, quite a bit.
So let's start with net neutrality, because that got a lot of attention, and you've talked with us on this program about it, but again, I don't think most people cared about it until late last year. It is exactly what?
Net neutrality is a rule that was created under the last administration by the FCC that requires that internet service providers, the company that delivers internet to your home, that they have to treat all content the same way. And so it can't treat certain kind of files differently and let some go through faster than others. And it can't treat content from certain sites faster than others. And most importantly, it can't block content from anywhere for any reason.
So as the year ended with the Trump FCC repealing net neutrality, who was pushing to get this done? Because there certainly seemed to be a wide range of opposition.
Right. The only group that's been in favor of this is the internet service providers, that telecom industry that sees the possibility of a new and additional revenue stream without that rule in place.
Okay. So do you expect the legal challenges that have cropped up, could it derail the repeal?
I think it's hard to say. I don't know enough about the legal intricacies to argue really one way or another. I think a lot of people are suggesting that we are likely headed to a place without net neutrality, though.
All right. And if we head to that place, who's happy, who's not, and why?
Well, we really don't know exactly. The internet service providers have said things,
yes,
but their words, I think, probably are less significant than their actions. And the fact that they have lobbied and given so much money in the name of getting rid of these rules suggests that, in fact, they're not going to continue with business as it has always been. But they do have the intention of going after companies that use the internet to make money and asking them to pay fees.
All right. So a case in point might be Netflix.
Right.
So what will that mean to those of us that want to sit down and watch Netflix?
And so we don't, again, know for certain. My expectation would be that if Netflix has to pay a fee in order to be in the fast lane and accessible to consumers.
Guess who's going to ultimately pay that?
Right. You know, if you look at the business model of Netflix, there isn't a lot of extra money in there. Right now, they're spending, you know, almost all of the money that they're making on additional programming. So either they're going to cut back on programming or they're going to pass that cost right along because they haven't built that into its model.
So we as consumers need to be watching for this idea of these paid fast lanes to see what if that comes to be, and then you can expect some changes.
Right. And I think the other thing that we should really keep in mind as consumers, Netflix is sort of an easier case, right? They obviously can pay. I think the bigger question has to do with what will the internet service providers do for public, government, educational sites? These are non-commercial sites that aren't making any revenue. And so the question is, does that mean that all of a sudden now your library, your city of Ann Arbor, your access to those sorts of sites, does that mean that it's now slower because those types of websites don't have the money to pay for that fast lane access?
Or little tiny companies that are trying to get them get life on the internet and don't have deep pockets.
Well, and that's, I think, a really important part of the story is that so much of the innovation that we've seen over the last two decades has to do with the fact that even though we just got net neutrality as a rule in 2015, it had been the de facto operating norm. And so all of the companies that have developed based on websites and communicating with customers in that way, and they were able to do that because they didn't have the enormous startup cost of getting into a fast lane to reach those customers. So in some ways, many of the companies that have established themselves now, let's say a company like Netflix, yes, it's going to likely be hit with these fees, but on the other hand, the chances of a competitor coming along are much lower now, at least that kind of a startup kind of company that would have to have the money to get into the fast lane. So this is something that really supports the incumbents of the web that are already there.
And then, as you pointed out in the piece you wrote for The Conversation, when you look at the internet service providers that own content, whether cable TV channels or film franchises versus those that don't, the companies that own the content will be able to charge lower prices than the companies that license it. Do I have that right?
Right. We're really heading into a new era of competition. And so this has to do with one of those pending mergers, AT&T
yes.
and Time Warner.
Let's go right down the path now to talk mergers and investments.
So for the most part, the way that our system, our television and internet system has worked is that the companies that provide the services haven't owned content. They just, you know, it's access. Mm-hmm. They didn't care what was going through the pipes. Mm-hmm. It just came through. That changed a little bit in 2011 when Comcast, one of the nation's largest internet service providers, bought NBC Universal, which is a broadcast channel and also many cable channels and a content producer. They have Universal Studios, big content. And because it was a broadcast network, there was a lot of FCC discussion about whether that was all right. And there were some rules, actually contingencies that were put on allowing the deal to go forward that would make sure that Comcast didn't hold that content hostage so that it wasn't a case where you had to be a Comcast provider in order to get access to the content. Well, in some ways, it seems like we've already forgotten about that very recent past. And so now the discussion is whether AT&T, also one of the nation's largest providers mm-hmm. of internet service, whether they should be allowed to purchase Time Warner. And this is the part of the Time Warner assets that are really all content. And so these are the Turner Networks, TBS, TNT, CNN, and perhaps most interesting to many, HBO.
Mm-hmm.
And so really the concern here is that that what we're looking at is a new strategy in competition among telecommunication providers, that they're going to try to use own content and use it as a way to encourage subscribers to switch to their service because they will be able to offer, let's say, if it's AT&T, let's say HBO costs $15 now. Let's say AT&T continues to offer HBO to AT&T subscribers for $15. But let's say that in their dealing with Comcast, they say, well, now if you want to be carrying HBO, then it's going to be $20, $30. And so Comcast will be in that position of having to pass those costs along. And all of a sudden, if you're interested in HBO, you've got this new incentive to switch to AT&T.
And all of this, kind of underpinning all of this, is there not kind of a national unplug from cable movement anyway?
Well, it's complicated.
Yeah.
I think the companies that we have thought about as cable companies for a long time have quietly been morphing into internet service providers. And so it's the case in the majority of the country that the company that used to be your cable provider, well, they may still be your cable provider, but they are also your internet service provider. And so, you know, all of these changes, you know, they're really in a great position because the margins on internet service are much higher than they are on cable because they're not having to pay for that content, whereas they do have to pay all of those cable channels they offer you a certain amount of money a month in order to be able to offer them. And so in many ways, the cable now internet service providers are making up for what they thought were the limits of their business. Mind you, these are very lucrative companies that in many cases, and this is really the big part of it, Cynthia, in most cases, they operate as monopolies. So regardless of what you think about regulation and deregulation in principle, even people who are against regulations, many of them understand that in cases where you have monopolies operating, that you do need some extra rules in order to make sure that the consumers have any kind of control or coverage in the situation.
And speaking of, we also need to talk about another kind of merger that could be happening, Sinclair Tribune. Which remind us again who these companies are, who are they, and what could this merger mean to consumers here in Michigan?
So we're all familiar, let's say, with our major broadcast television networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, the CW. Well, for the most part, even though we think of them as those national networks, the actual stations that are in our cities around Michigan, in Detroit, in Lansing, in Grand Rapids, and Flint, they are not actually owned by those networks. Instead, there are these other kinds of companies called station ownership groups, and that's what both Sinclair and Tribune are. In addition, they also own, Tribune owns a lot of newspapers too, but that's another story.
Trunk.
yeah. So these are two companies that own stations that are merging or are trying to merge. There's a discussion about it because by putting these two companies together, they would own the new entity would own well over what the national cap has been.
Yeah, because the national cap is what, around 40%? And this would be over 70% if these two merge. How is this being allowed to happen?
Well, we have a new, very deregulatory FCC, and so that's a lot of the answer there. Right now, part of why the deal hasn't gone all the way through is there's an expectation that Sinclair is going to sell some of the stations. And so that story broke last week that it may be selling some of the stations to Fox. So we'll see what happens there.
What stations in Michigan are we talking about?
So if you're in Flint, Grand Rapids, and Kalamazoo, or in Traverse City, in those markets, those are the ones that are most affected. So in Flint, it is already the case, and I, in terms of rules, I'm not exactly even sure how this happened, but the NBC, CW, and Fox affiliate are already all owned by Sinclair. I think that has to do with the fact that both CW and Fox are not considered full-service networks, and so there's another rule that prevents owning two major broadcasters in one city, and that's probably how that was allowed.
Okay.
In Grand Rapids, now Grand Rapids is actually the most interesting market for this story because Sinclair owns the CBS affiliate and Tribune owns the Fox. And so, again, it might be the case that Fox is considered not a full-service network. It's a younger network. If you can remember back, Fox just launched in the late 80s. And they don't provide as much programming as ABC, NBC, and CBS have historically. And so, as a result, they've been able to argue that they're not they shouldn't be regulated the same way. And then in Traverse City, it is already the case that Sinclair owns both the NBC and ABC affiliates.
And the point needs to be noted here that Sinclair's got this track record of forcing stations to air the same editorials and providing content that is kind of served up as local.
Correct. And this is really something, they're called must runs, and they're really contrary to the way that U.S. broadcasting policy developed. In U.S. broadcasting policy, the networks are not regulated at all. It's the stations that the FCC can regulate. And that was done in order to make sure that stations served the communities that they were in, sort of with the recognition that not all communities around the country are the same. Well, that policy and regulatory goal has sort of been – has come into conflict with the increasing conglomeration that has occurred over years of deregulation that have allowed stations to not be owned by a local family or a local business, but in these large station groups. So historically, stations have been allowed to not run the things that their networks offer. And that's really where the bulk of the policy discussion has been. So if ABC is running an episode of something that doesn't seem to fit the local standards, they preempt it, which means they run something else, and they're totally allowed to do that. No harm, no foul. But what's happening here is in the actual newscast, and that Sinclair is saying that this is part of the newscast and it has to be part of the newscast, and that the local stations aren't having the ability to say, you know, the perspective that's being expressed here really doesn't match the personality we have in our community or the ideas that are you know, fit our community. And so, you know, this is really... It's concerning, one, because of the sort of forced nature of the content, and then on top of that, this idea that now we're looking at going from having Sinclair stations in so many more markets.
And so in this era of relaxed regulations, or defanged, if you will, so what do you think the big takeaway will be when we, for 2018, when we see, talk about net neutrality, or we talk about these mergers and investments?
Well, I think what's happening right now is that there's so much attention on some of the concerns around the big tech companies that are also very uncertainly or not at all regulated right now. And so to some degree, I feel like as a society, maybe we've taken our eyes off the ball, right? We've forgotten about how important something like local broadcasters are because we're, you know, starting to ask these questions about what Facebook does and what Google do. And so I think one of the key things is to recognize how significant these older media structures continue to be in our societies, especially in areas such as local news, which, again, is another big concern when you have this kind of conglomeration. To what degree does that mean that the kind of television news that's going to be pushed in is being created elsewhere in its sort of generalized coverage of stories rather than particular coverage of stories that are meaningful to different communities? And, you know, this is already on top of cities that have already lost newspapers. So without newspapers, without local television stations, you know, we are really dependent on services here in Michigan like Michigan Radio that are covering the stories that are meaningful to Michiganders.
So if you were betting, who's going to be losing out as all this plays out?
It's the consumers, because at the end of the day, you know, there are billions of dollars that these companies have. Mind you, in many cases, they're the dollars that we send them every month for our internet and cable service. But they've used those dollars in order to lobby regulators to have policies that work for them. And it's just the case that there really aren't groups that are able to, you know, stand up and organize and explain, you know, what seem to be complicated issues, but there really aren't, to people to have them really care and ask their legislators. Because really, at the end of the day, that's what needs to happen, is that we need to talk to our legislators. And instead of the FCC as a government agency making rules that it can then just turn around and remake in the next administration, what we really need is legislators to craft policy that is responsive to what consumers want, not what these companies want.
Amanda Lotz is fellow at the Peabody Media Center and professor of media at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much. It's always great talking with you.
Oh, it's always my pleasure.
There are efforts underway to modernize Michigan's 911 system. We plan to discuss the details this week on Stateside, but first we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about 911 in Michigan? We also want to hear your stories. Have you called 911 recently? Did everything go smoothly or were there hiccups? Tell us about your experience. Leave us a voicemail at 734-764-7840. Again, that number is 734-764-7840. Or just go to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org and share your story there. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings, engineered by Mike Blank. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Candy, thanks for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.